Hi, Graham. How you doing?
Good, thank you, Mel. How are you keeping?
I'm good, thank you. Looking forward to today's podcast. So we have Val Flight, who is head of payroll at Westpac Group, and Val is speaking to us all the way from Australia today. So welcome, Val.
Thanks, Mel, and thanks, Graham. Nice to be here.
Lovely to meet you. Let's dive right in. Cast your mind back. There's a lot of times that people don't think about payroll, that payroll just happens and that it doesn't get thought about. But actually, if you think about your own personal experience of pay, it's often very personal, right? What you do with the money, how you earned it. So I'd love to hear from you about your first ever paycheck. What work were you doing when you got that first paycheck, and what did you spend the money on?
Oh God. Okay, so how far back are we going? First full-time job or first casual job while you're at school?
The first one that you got paid for that came with a little bit of a pay slip that said, hey, this is you're making your own money.
Oh, okay. So my first job where I actually physically got a pay slip. Oh, what would I have done with it? I'm assuming I would have actually probably gone shopping, actually, to be honest. Like I was, what, 17, right? So I had a couple of casual jobs before that, but it was cash in hand and, you got it in an envelope at the end of the week. and there was no transfer or any pay slip or anything else like that. But probably the first one where I got a pay slip was actually 7-Eleven. So yes, I worked at a 7-Eleven after hours after school. And I would have spent it absolutely on it. It would have been clothes, to be honest. Like, wasn't old enough to drink then and go out.
Fair enough. I always associate 7-Eleven with slush puppies, because there's always one
Correct.
in a convenience store. And so where in the world was this happening, right? So 17-year-old Val is working in the 7-Eleven. In what part of the world?
In Australia, so in a town called Wollongong, which is like 2 hours south of Sydney,
Right. So you're in
on the
the you're in
seaside.
the convenience store, normal convenience store, just running, you get your pay slip, you head out and spend the money. And then you're off and running. That's your first proper paid job. So how did you go from that to being the person who organizes the pay slip and that connection into payroll? How did you come to be in payroll?
All right. So I fell into payroll like most people do, right? It wasn't something that I kind of left school and thought I would do. I actually left school and did a diploma in a business, actually majoring in travel and tourism, funnily enough. Never worked in travel, went and worked at the RBA, so the Reserve Bank of Australia. And I was actually an analyst. So I did a whole stack of data entry and then had the luxury of reading bank statements and putting graphs together for board reports. And then obviously was very good with numbers and was just like, well, would you like to go and try your hand in payroll? And I was like, sure. Like it was systems, it was like number crunching. So actually started my career in payroll at the Reserve Bank.
Right. And what was the technology like in those days?
Oh God. Okay, from a payroll perspective, we were on a very early version of PeopleSoft. So that was my first payroll platform. We used it internally for both HR, finance, and payroll. So they were a full PeopleSoft shop across the board, everything. So that was literally my first foray into the payroll platform perspective. So it was actually quite, one, sophisticated compared to other platforms out there, but it was also quite a hard platform to learn. So in terms of running reports, writing reports and so on, it requires quite a bit of a understanding of how the system works and all of the kind of code language, right? Because nothing was kind of user-friendly, which in some ways was probably not a bad thing, to be honest, because I kind of started with the hardest and then went to some easier ones.
And how did you learn? Because there's some of these, the story of technology is it's supposed to get easier to use, the sort of that ultimate description of technology that's so easy it requires no training. But often a power user is going to pick up skills along the way. So was there structured training that the employer provided, or was it you're fresh into the department, you sit with the people who are using the tools today and just copy what they're doing?
Yep, pretty much that's the way it went, right? So we did have some simple instructions to use, but it was really sitting with some of the more senior people, including the manager at the time, and learning how to use the system from them. And then I was lucky enough to actually be asked to participate in the upgrade. We're doing an upgrade. And so for me, that meant reading all of the release documents and stuff like that. And then that's where you found the kind of, okay, well, are we really using the system as efficiently as what we should be? And then that's when I realized I actually really like delving into the system and pulling it apart, right? And trying to break it. So went into that testing methodology of going, okay, I'm going to try and break this system. But like most people initially, it was like you're learning from the person, a more senior person in the department. We know that that can be good or it can be bad depending on the level of ability that those people have. But I did a lot of reading behind the scenes as well.
And so we're talking about an on-premise deployment of the system. Kind of visualize for me, if you can, reading release notes. Is that like 10 pages of PDFs or were you getting like full manuals that you were having to?
Like full manuals, around about 300 to 400 pages long. And, you know, you had to work out what you were using, what you weren't using, you know, what it meant for your business. And as well as PeopleSoft was a global platform, right? So you had releases for different countries. So also working out what was Australia specific, what was global, but had a touch point to Australia. It's not everyone's cup of tea, but you got to really want to kind of learn and you got to want to be in the detail because otherwise it's quite dry, to be honest.
And has that changed over time? It obviously as things have moved to cloud and as user experiences have improved, or do you still take joy in kind of lifting the lid and digging in and reading whatever you can find?
I still take joy in lifting the lid and diving in. Some people think that I'm too detailed, right? And I get that feedback quite a bit. Typically, it's from IT people, honestly, like where they go, "What do you mean you know all of this stuff?" But yeah, I'm still very detailed and I still like to read the release notes to understand what our vendors are actually giving us, what the capabilities are, you know, what improvements they've made and whether there's anything that we can kind of implement that gets rid of a potential manual process we might still have just because we didn't realise that the technology was there. So very much still into reading release notes.
So I assume that the deployment, the upgrade went well. It was a success. Yeah. What does it look like in a payroll and HR function for a system upgrade to go well? Is there an upside or is it just minimizing the downside?
Okay, so I've had both. So depending on which organization I've been in, there's been very much, let's just leave it as status quo. We're not looking for improvements. We're literally just doing an upgrade because we have to, right? Typically it's because we're coming out of support or, you know, it's a major upgrade that we need to do from a statutory perspective. So I've had both. And then I've had the luxury of going, no, we're upgrading because we want all the bells and whistles, right? So we want to actually make improvements into our processes and how we do things. So I've been lucky to have both. But it's a fine line. Typically, it's a budget thing that sways the approach, right? So typically, when you're doing an upgrade, it's much cheaper to just do a lift and shift, right? Like literally, what you've got today is what you're going to get in the future. Whereas when you're bringing in some of that newer functionality and so on, typically there's an additional cost involved only because it involves other departments or it actually requires you to re-engineer some of your processes or your integrations. So it really kind of depends on that piece.
Yeah. And I mean, that's interesting. You used the word process twice there as you were thinking about the upgrade impact. And I think oftentimes a software upgrade, people will look at, okay, what's the software going to do for me? And it sounds like your approach is, what can I do with this software? So there's a bit of a chicken and egg piece there in terms of you dive into the manuals and you read what it's capable of. But those are the release notes. So the product's already there. And then do you redesign your processes around the release notes? So can you talk us through how you approach that and how you balance that, you know, wanting to redesign your own process, but looking at standardized tools and upgrades in the software?
Yeah. So the first thing I do when I do read the release notes, the first thing I do is kind of highlight any of the things that I know we manually have to do today. Right. So they're pain points for the team or they're actual really manual tasks, which obviously the more manual you are, the more risks you hold within your function. So that's the first thing that I do. And then I go, is it a process that just sits in my world or is it actually going to require having discussions with other stakeholders out in the business because that the process or the changes that we could potentially do may have downstream or upstream impacts. So typically that's the way I approach it. I'm always looking at how I can make things actually better for my team, right? One, it stops the whinging, right, about how hard things are or not how hard or, you know, how monotonous it can be. But also, it's also making sure that we're actually covering our risks. So in the probably in the last 5 to 6 years, even a little bit more, it's been a real risk focus. So it's in terms of how do we reduce the risk of things going wrong? How do we reduce the risk of, you know, manual human error in some of our processes? So it's taken that kind of lens, and that's because of the environment that we're in Australia at the moment, where, you know, our regulators are coming in, right, and really kind of questioning everything. It's very much an employee perspective that they've got, right? So it's literally your employee is 100% right until you prove otherwise, kind of thing. Which then means that when you're looking at your software piece, there's always that risk lens attached to it and that compliance lens.
Because you've got so much going on at the moment. I know obviously your role is a global role, but you've got so much going on in Australia at the moment, haven't you?
Yeah, there's a lot going on in Australia, and you know, I'm probably lucky that I only look after Australia in the current company that I'm in, right? So it was global previously. But compared to our offshore locations like Singapore and the UK and so on, we are the ones that have got the highest amount of scrutiny at this point in time
Because
from a
there's,
country.
for those that aren't aware, there's I think, has it been like the last 4 years? There's been a lot of there's been a lot of press about wage theft, which was called then, and we're trying to change it to wage trust. And it's not just, you know, the small press, you know, like the local press. It's actually hitting mainstream, isn't it? So,
Yeah, it is. It is. And what the regulator does. So typically what is happening is obviously there was the first case, 7-Eleven was the first case that hit the newspapers around underpayment of employees. There was already some large organizations that had self-disclosed and were kind of actively looking at their payrolls on the back end of that. And that caused a lot of large organization in Australia to actually go back and review and go, oh, could we potentially have an issue. And so, but Fair Work have also made it very clear to large organizations. So when the commissioner first came in around 4 to 5 years ago, she made it very clear. I remember going to a PwC like managers forum, and she was a guest speaker, and she made it very clear to everyone in the room and listening in that large organizations and all organizations, but predominantly large organizations, were being given a, you know, heads up, you know, we will find any underpayments that are occurring because, you know, it's the wrong thing to do. So she made that very clear. She also made it very clear at that point in time, which I think caused a bit of a ripple with payroll managers around Australia, was like, well, if you're being told to do the wrong thing, you should find yourself another job. I'm like, yeah, great, but when you're the main income earner for your family, that's probably not going to fly, right? Like, well, do I just leave because it's the wrong thing to do, or do I want a paycheck still, right? So it was quite interesting because at that point it made a lot of people scared. And then I think that kind of settled, and people were like, okay, well, this is what the new world's going to be like. I think our change of government made it worse, to be honest. So when the Labor government came in a couple of years ago now, obviously, that's where all the IR reforms have come in and so on. So they have kind of given more power to Fair Work. And so we're seeing the outcomes of that with all of the industrial relations reforms that are happening in Australia at the moment as well.
And tell me if I'm wrong here. I know you will. Did they also say that if the payroll manager was aware of the underpayments, so there could be a threat to go to prison or, you know,
Criminal.
it,
Yeah, so the way. So they've got the loopholes bill that's just come in. So, and what that is it's criminalised with wage theft, right? So it's when you're actively knowing that you're not doing the right thing. So it's not for honest mistakes and things like that. And they made that quite clear. So that criminal offence only comes in on 1 Jan 2025. So obviously the legislation's come in, but in terms of actually penalising people, and it's at all levels. So it's even down to, you know, your people managers, if they're actively not putting in time sheets and so on, they can be held accountable from a criminal offence perspective.
Yeah.
So,
So you've got the pressure of business as usual, but you've also got the additional pressure. And I know it's been spoken a lot, isn't it, about in the not necessarily just the press, but also within payroll circles.
Yeah, in the payroll industry, it's a big hot topic, right? Because obviously it's made people quite nervous. Not because I think people are doing things wrong. I think people are just nervous on the fact that, there's now criminal charges and so on. And you don't know until you see that first case go through, right? So it's one of those things of, well, let's wait and see, and then see who the first person is that goes through that and what the outcomes are of that. And I think quite often in Australia, that's what happens. We wait until the big cases come in. So, for example, CBA last week announced in the papers that, they'd been fined. So they were taken to court by Fair Work and were fined $10 million, right? So it kind of reinforces the thing that, reinforces the messages to other organizations that if
And
required, Fair Work will go the whole way kind of thing. So.
how horrible if you are that first test case.
I'd rather not be.
No, but it's just always the way, isn't
Absolutely.
it? The large organizations, and you're the payroll manager or leader or director,
Yeah.
and yeah.
I do joke around telling people that, on my bucket list is not looking inside a prison cell.
No.
I mean, compliance is it's a universal issue around payroll. But for those unfamiliar with the specific situation in Australia, is there an easy explanation for how so much of how wage theft or wage trust became such a big issue? How was it that mistakes were made and people were unaware that they weren't paying
Yeah.
accurately? I mean, we talk about the raison d'être for payroll is, accuracy and compliance. So there's all these well-intentioned people doing the best they can. How did it come about that there were gaps in that?
Yeah, so one to start off with is the award. So we've got an award system in Australia, right? So there's over 100 awards that are out there. And so they set the terms and conditions of employment in different industries. Now, then what you have on top of that is a lot of organizations will have what they call an enterprise agreement or a collective agreement, which kind of oversits, like sits over the top of that award piece. And so they're quite complex, to be honest, right? And everyone interprets the clauses very differently in terms of how they're written. So you give it to a lawyer, they'll interpret it one way. You give it to a payroll person, they'll interpret another way. And you give it to, a HR person or an employee, and they will interpret it as something completely different. So that's issue number one. Issue number two is there was a real big mentality of set and forget, right? So you implement your payroll platform and you forget to go back and re-review, typically around pay element codes or pay wage codes and so on. So a lot of it is around that piece. And then we've got a unique scenario where we have what we call long service leave. Typically, a lot of organizations, that's where they have also had some issues, right? So it's quite complex. Each state has different rules around it, different accrual rates, different entitlement dates, and the rest of it. So when you're looking at it, you've got seven states in Australia. They all do long service leave very different, which is an entitlement for pretty much everyone that works full time in Australia or works permanently in Australia. And then you've got the fact that you then have an award system that is very complex. And as time goes, your interpretation changes. So as the environment changes, the interpretation also changes. And so again, people have kind of gone, oh yeah, it's all set up in the system, and they don't go back and re-review it
Right.
as
Thank
well.
you. That's super helpful. And I think, anyone listening who has maybe based in the US or based in Europe and has an operation in Australia, there is a probably pricked up and thought, I bet the local team's dealing with it, but I probably need to just check on that. So thank you. It was a really deep specialist area of expertise. And as Mel said, it's something we've seen some of the headlines about, gets talked about, but it's lovely to hear the kind of on the ground perspective. And then also you kind of dived in. We went down a little bit of a rabbit hole on the release notes because that's the first time in these conversations, Mel, we've really sort of talked about the release notes and the software upgrade and that process. So I want to take us back. So a little bit more about your career, if we can, and kind of you mentioned that you're now focused on Australia, but you had a global stint in between. So how did you get into global from kind of falling into payroll and beginning to experiment with systems? How did you get into global payroll?
So I was working for Macquarie Bank at the time, and I actually started as their Australian payroll manager. So they had approached me on a role for Australia payroll, and I said yes, I'd come in and do it. So I moved across Global head of payroll left the organization. The head of HR at the time asked me if I would go into that global role. And I was just like, yep, I can do this. And then I went home and went, oh my God, what the hell have I done? Like, how am I going to ever learn 45 countries? I'd only ever done Australia and New Zealand at that point. I was just like, oh my God, how am I ever going to wrap my head around this? Quickly learned that I had a lot to learn, right? And really sat with my team. So we used to run global payroll other than the UK and US and Canada out of Sydney. We then moved and created a global shared function in Manila. So I actually moved my family to Manila for 2 years while we set that up from scratch. And then what we did was we actually moved UK, US, and Canada also into the Manila Global Centre. And to be honest, it was probably a really good, for me, it was a huge step in my career, but it's also what actually put me onto that transformation journey as well, from a payroll perspective. And the reason I say that is one is we had in-house payroll. So again, they were using PeopleSoft for Australia because Australia was our biggest payroll at Macquarie Bank. But then we're also using quite a lot of vendors in country. So it gave me that whole vendor partnership experience. Which I hadn't had before because we were always an in-house payroll in all the other organizations I'd worked in. So that gave me a really good understanding of how to work with a payroll vendor and the complexity that you have when you're not actually processing the pay yourself, right? So you're very reliant on your vendor doing the right thing and then you're just checking the reports that come back. It also showed me that, you know, it's really important that you have a really good relationship with your vendor and that you can trust them, especially in countries like China and so on, where, you know, the legislation's not written in English, right? You need somebody to translate the legislation. And that was probably the hardest. So Japan, China, even Germany, it was really hard to kind of find stuff in English or translate it in English. And so when you're not in country, it's always a little bit more difficult. It also meant that you had to have really strong relationships with your HR counterparts that were in country, right? Because they were pretty much your eyes and ears on the ground in terms of what was happening. But that was literally my first role on a global scale.
And it's, I mean, so there's a couple of things there that I think are just fascinating. First one is just the sheer amount of change in such a short period of time. So from a single country role to a global role, working with vendors, not doing it in-house, and then relocating your family to Manila. So let's just, you talked a little bit about the difficulty to get insight and information in local language. What's it like stepping into existing vendor relationships and, you know, as somebody who likes to lift the lid and read the software release manuals, et cetera, how did you approach learning about those vendor partners and how to get the best of those relationships?
So the first thing I did was actually sit with my team who had been working with the partners for quite a while and got their inputs in terms of how they felt the relationship was going. But we also then went and met, I actually met with all of our vendors, so both the account managers, but also the people who were actually processing our actual pay run. It was also a mind shift change because it was very much an us versus them mentality, to be honest, with our vendors. Like they didn't see, even my own team didn't see the vendor partner as an extension of our team. And that's a really important piece, right? Because you're only as good as the people that are actually processing. So even our account manager could have been great, but if the people actually processing our pay for us didn't understand, then we had an issue. So it was really important to have really good relationships with them. We also gave them an open door to come and ask questions and be transparent with us. And that seemed to work quite well. Obviously, you can't see everything. And for me, it was a huge learning that I had to have a really good level of trust. But then if we found things, we needed to raise it in the right way, right? Rather than kind of finger pointing at where it all kind of all went wrong. But that was a bit of a learning curve for me because I'm a Virgo, so I'm a bit of a perfectionist, right? So very hard to let go of something and very hard to know that you're handing stuff over. Having said that, it's also acknowledging the fact that it's very hard to run a payroll when you're not in country, right? So it's also understanding that the value of those vendors is the fact that they are in country, they are up to date, they do see the news. It's like anyone, you know, when I went to the Philippines, I was paid on the local payroll. And it's really interesting because once I was on the payroll and being paid, I was aware of all the things that happened, or that I was in all my entitlements, I understood the taxes. because I was being paid, and I could see the news articles around all the things that, you know, the Department of Labor was doing and things like that, because I was in country. Whereas when you're not in country, it's a much harder thing. And if you're not being paid in that currency or in that country, it's a different level of understanding you've got, because you're not hearing all of these news stories and things like that. So, for example, even in Australia, we're talking about the fact that wage theft is in the newspapers. But if you're not in Australia, you don't really understand how big of an issue it is, or, you know, how in-depth it is and how it's impacted. Everyone's talking about it. So with the vendors, that was a big learning curve for me in terms of the value that they can add, but it also means that you've really got to nurture that relationship and see them as an extension of your team rather than, well, I'm paying for a service and I just expect you're going to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And then you touched on earlier on when you were talking about the Australia Fair Work and the responsibility on a payroller being the primary breadwinner and having to make a decision about your job. So I'm imagining you driving home after that meeting when you've said to your boss, yeah, I can do global. And then 12 months later or whatever, it's driving home and reaching that decision that, okay, we're going to relocate the family to Manila. That decision-making process, how did you go through that decision? Was it just simply a no-brainer, this is the right thing to do, or?
Yeah, so drove home, and hubby and I had already planned to go out for dinner. And so my mum and dad had the kids, and we had our eldest son who was, what, 17, and our youngest that was 7. And we went out for dinner, and I said to him, look, I said, Sean, I've got a question to ask you, you know, like, how would you feel about going and living in Manila for a couple of years? And he was like, absolutely. When can I resign, and when are we going, right? And he was just like, and I was just like, okay. So obviously he was very much on board in terms of being able to kind of go and experience. We saw it as a bit of an adventure, I guess, in terms of being able to experience a different culture, you know, once in a lifetime opportunity was how we kind of saw it. And we were like, well, it's a 2-year assignment, right? And if at the end of the day, if we really can't settle there or we don't like it, you know what, we can always come home, right? Like, it's not the end of the world. Our eldest son had a little bit more. He was just like, no, I'm staying here. And we're like, okay, well, if you want to stay in Australia, you can like live with my mum and dad and finish school. And then we went over there because I had to do a couple of interviews to actually start looking for my team. So we actually went over there to find an apartment and have a look around, and we spent 2 weeks there. And our younger son came with us, our oldest son stayed home, and then halfway through he rang me and was like, can you fly me over so I can have a look at what this place is like? And we're like, yeah, okay. So we flew him over and he spent a week, and then he was like, all right, I think I'll come. Because I had said to him, you know, it's up to you, but don't come and blame me, you know, 10 years down the track when you say, oh, I missed on an opportunity. And so he came along, and funny enough, met his wife in Manila, working together, and then when we moved home, they did the long distance relationship for a long time, and then they got married in 2019. So we keep telling him, like, lucky you came across, because you wouldn't have met her otherwise, like, you know. But it was a huge culture change as well for us. Having said that, it was actually quite nice to. It's a very different culture. It's very family orientated. So from that side, values were quite well aligned. We're very family orientated and, you know, very respectful and things like that. So from that side, it wasn't a culture shock. I think the culture shock was more in terms of, you know, the speed of the internet, you know, how inefficient some of the processes are over there. You know, if you're going to buy, a loaf of bread and some milk, you can expect it to take about 15 to 20 minutes to get through the checkouts, right? Because you have one person who scans and one person who checks the receipt and one person who bags it, and then you finally get your goods and you can walk out the door. So those little things like that were like, what? Like, you know, it makes no sense to us. But having said that, it also was a great time, even for our younger son, who was 7. No toy catalogs. You make friends for who they are, not for what you've got. We kind of disassociated ourselves from the expats, and I know that probably sounds pretty bad, but for us it was about, you know, treating the locals just like we would treat anyone else at home, like we were no better off, you know. And that was really important for us, and it was a great time for us just to gel as a family as well, like, you know. And we got to travel a little bit around Asia, being centrally located. So from that perspective, and hubby was like, on his arrival card back into Australia when we'd come home for Christmas, retired was his thing, right? Because he was just like, I'm not going back to work. And I'm like, when we get back to Australia, you're going back to work, right? Like, this is just a little vacation. and we've done it a couple of times. I've been really lucky, you know.
Do you think it changed you those 2 years? Did it slow you down personally?
I don't think it did, actually. I think for me, it actually probably helped my career in terms of having that global presence, having set up an actual offshore function, having done some, you know, we did some vendor changes while we were over there as well. But it gave me a very different perspective in terms of being very patient with working with offshore. So, you know, a lot of people are very negative around using offshore vendors and having teams offshore and offshoring in general, right? So there's still this whole thing of, you know, why are you offshoring to India or why are you offshoring to Manila and things like that. But for me, it gave me a very different perspective. They're actually really, they really do want to do well for you, right, as a client. But it taught me a huge amount of patience and it taught me how to mentor people and coach people in a very different way. And it kind of opened that side of my career up a lot more, right, where, to be honest, it's the only time in my whole career where I've handpicked 40 people to come and work for me, right? Like, it was literally a dream of being able to handpick your team. And just hearing some of the stories that of their careers in terms of other BPOs and stuff like that that they had worked for made you realize just how hard some of our clients actually, you know, how horrible clients can be, right? And remembering that it's a human at the end of the day that's on the other side doing this piece of work for you. So it gave me a very different management style, I guess, or it just added to the management style of actually understanding how to manage people who are offshore. You can't see day to day, so there's a full level of trust in terms of what they're doing and what they're producing.
And it's a rare opportunity to go and build a team of 40. And it sounds like you may have done it a couple of times from what you were saying in terms of building teams. So what do you look for in a payroller, and what advice would you offer somebody who's coming into the industry now?
Okay, so for somebody coming in new into the industry, I kind of, my first thing would be very open-minded, right? The payroll industry has changed a lot. And I think people used to just see payroll as a data entry career, right? Very manual, very data entry, not kind of seen. It's changed a lot. And there's a lot of different career paths in the payroll industry nowadays, right? Like, if you kind of think about it more than just the transactional piece, it's around how do you use the data? What insights are you getting into? It's the customer service piece, right? Because at the end of the day, our employees are our customers, right? So we might not be front facing and all the rest of it, but usually the biggest bill that any organization has is their wage bill, right? It's their people. And so it's getting the team to understand that. And for somebody coming in, I kind of go, it's pretty exciting. It's a very thankless job. So I'm like, I always say to people in interviews, if you're looking for constant praise from people outside of us, you're probably not going to get it. And this is probably not the career path that you want to take, right? Like, I don't think I've ever had employees ever ring me to say, thanks, you paid me right this week, right? I kind of go, no news is good news when you're working in the payroll space. But, you know, it can be quite rewarding in terms of just how much insights you can give the business. So it really depends on the person as well and the type of personality they have and the drive that they've got, but there is a huge career path in payroll nowadays.
So in Australia, is there a lack of people coming into the payroll industry?
I wouldn't say there's a lack of people. There's probably no people leaving high school yet and wanting a career in payroll, right? So that is one of the things that I know that quite a few of the associations in Australia have been trying to tap into, is how do we get into those kind of career fairs at high schools and things like that. I still think it's very much something that you fall into, right? Or, you know, or you do finance and then you kind of get into payroll from that side of things. I still don't think it's at that point where people leave school and go, yeah, I'm going to go and work in payroll, which would be great if that's what we got to. Having said that, we do have quite a lot of people that once they're in payroll, they absolutely love payroll, right? So typically, you know, it's, you either love it or you hate it. It's not one of those typical jobs that you kind of go, ah, oh, it's okay and I'm happy to continue doing it. You either really do love it or you really don't like it and, you know, you kind of move on. And then you've got people who really kind of go, okay, well, I'll do payroll. And then they kind of go, I'll do a bit of HR. So I was really lucky in my career. I did both at one stage for one organization. I was actually a HR business partner and still doing payroll. And that gave me a very different perspective, right? Because sometimes, we can be quite harsh in payroll, right? Where we go, stop to asking us to do everything for you. And we forget that the HR business partner or HR manager's in the middle of the business and us, like they're the middle person, don't shoot the messenger kind of thing. But typically that's what we see is people will start in payroll and then go off and do something else, or we'll start somewhere else and come into payroll and then kind of stay in payroll.
Can I ask the question? I know obviously we're finding out about yourself, but what's your thoughts for payroll? Should it be in HR, finance, or its own department? The good old question that's debated all the time.
Good question. Look, I don't think it really matters where it sits, to be honest. I've been in both finance and HR, and I've actually been in operations where payroll sat in operations. In my current company, from a Westpac perspective, it doesn't actually sit in either. It doesn't sit in HR or finance. Having said that, I am part of what we call HR services, which is part of corporate services, where we're the operational side of HR, rather than being part of the HR job family as such. To be honest, I don't think it really matters where it sits. It's about having those key relationships with both of those, right? And having, and for them understanding that you're a key to their processes, right? And having an equal seat at the table. And that's probably the harder bit to get to, where, everyone kind of goes, oh no, we need to engage payroll because this will have a touch point with payroll. And that's probably the hardest piece. I kind of personally kind of go sits well with HR because then that way, it's connected to your policies, connected to your industrial relations teams and things like that. But it really comes down to the relationships you actually have.
So we're chatting on video, and you did a really interesting hand gesture then when you talked about where it sits, and that you kind of signaled out to both left and right in terms of looking sideways and across. And that's the theme we touched on quite a bit in some of the recent interviews, is that changing role of the payroller, not just to focus up and down inside their organization, but to look left and right and build those bridges out. So can you share a few tips on how to do that successfully from the payroll function to look out into both finance and HR and more broadly?
So to be honest, I think the first thing is you've got to be willing to step out of your comfort zone and give a lot more than what you'll get, right? So typically what it is that you end up having to take that first step, right? So they're not going to come and engage with you, right? So it's how you can show them that you can add value, ask lots of questions, kind of have regular catch-ups with them, show them that you can actually help them, right? So I did a lot of stuff when I first started to go, here's all the information we're seeing. Here's what we're seeing. We're seeing huge amounts of overtime in this part of the business, or we're seeing this happening in this part of the business. And then they're like, oh, that's really interesting. We've never known that before. And then they come back and ask you for more. So at the start, it feels like you're giving 100% and getting nothing back, right? But it's actually building that trust level and getting them to realize that you actually are a subject matter expert, right? In terms of, here's what I'm telling, here's what I can help you with. Here's what I can give you. Here's what I'm seeing based on the data that we're seeing come through payroll. If you hear of a policy, have you thought about the fact that this is going to impact the systems? Because they don't realize it, right? So people very much work in their silos and forget that some of the decisions that are made will have an impact downstream. And typically payroll is downstream, right? So I spend a lot of times doing kind of what I call value add. So that kind of consulting and going, oh, have you thought about this? We do newsletters, so that people are aware of all the changes that are happening, what it could potentially mean to Westpac itself at the moment. And then providing stats and stuff. So in most organizations, we've always done statistics around number of hires, number of terms, overpayments and what's causing those. And then, where we're seeing bottlenecks in workflows and things like that. And it's having that data, and typically people go, oh, okay, you're showing me in black and white, because quite often, people go, oh, really? Is it as bad as what you're saying it is? Or, is it really an issue? And I guess that's where we're pretty lucky in payroll, right? Because you've got the data to substantiate what you're actually talking about, right? So it helps to build the credibility up as well. But in both cases for finance and HR, it's been around, well, what can we help them with, right? And once they see that you're actually can add value to their own processes, or that, you can help them get rid of a problem or help them with an issue, typically that opens up the relationship a lot. But it also means that you've got to be willing to kind of go, well, I'm going to have to give more than I get, but
Yeah,
it comes back.
I guess there's an incremental piece of work there, right, isn't there? Because it's not just about running the payroll, and you've said, it's not just about the data entry, it's the reporting analytics. So you're obviously leveraging technology to allow you to do that, to drive productivity, to surface up the data in ways that you can use. So maybe now's a good time to look forward and think about, a lot of discussion at the moment about what technology can do for payroll and with payroll. Particularly in the area of AI and generative AI. What are you thinking about the future of technology for payroll?
For me, there's a couple of things that I would love to see from a technology perspective in the payroll industry, right? One is I think there definitely is a space for Gen AI, right? It's never going to get rid of the human. I think, at the end of the day, you still need that level of empathy when you're talking to people who are upset because their pay's wrong or whatnot, right? So I kind of go, there is still going to always be a level of human in that needs to happen. But I think where it can become smart is around that compliance piece, right? And having that Gen AI technology that helps you look at your trend analysis and things like that, right? Looking at your data processes, streamlining some of that, some of the processes that you currently have, whether it's your hire, terminations or whatnot. But I think for me, it's really around those data analytics and kind of looking at those trends and then going, well, where are our red flags, right? And having the system tell you where your red flags are rather than you having to go through your data looking for them, right? Or having you kind of get a hunch that something doesn't feel right and then you've got to go and investigate. Or, you get a question asked and then it kind of starts your mind ticking along to go, oh, we might have a bigger issue than we think, right? And then you go trying to find it. So I definitely think there's a spot for that. And I'd like to see it get to that point where it's quite smart in terms of giving you the updates in terms of the compliance updates, for example, right? So one of the hardest things and one of the questions I get asked quite a lot is around, well, how do you keep up with all the legislative changes? How do you keep up with what's happening in that space, and then how do you then convert that into what that means for your organization? And I think that's where I think the technology could potentially go to, right? Where it's getting feeds in from your regulators and things like that, and can do that smart thinking for you in terms of, well, this is what it actually means, right? From a payroll process perspective.
Fantastic. I think, yeah, there's no manual. We're all going to have to figure this out as we go, which is to do with the emerging technology. But I think there's a lot of exciting potential, both in terms of the industry as a whole, and obviously from what I see from inside a technology provider and the work that's being done. So yeah, I think it's going to be an exciting time. Payroll is always exciting. Nothing stood still. I've been in and around this space for 7 years, and nothing stood still. And everything is different, almost week by week, month by month, with the way the regulatory environment develops. So, okay, well, we're coming towards the end, on time. Mel, any additional thoughts or questions?
I loved your interview, Val. And I think one of the key things that we keep seeing with people that we meet on these podcasts is to continuously review, make sure you have build relationships, networking, and data. I think they're key things that we hear all the time. And I think this year I've heard so many people say, just make sure you review. Don't just implement something, keep reviewing and reviewing. And I think what you said there is such good advice, really. And for the audience, don't assume, isn't it? Just keep reviewing.
Yeah, you got to be curious, right? Because if you're not, that's typically where you'll get yourself into trouble, right? It's continue to question. It doesn't mean that there will be things wrong, and ideally, you don't want to find anything being wrong. But I think you got to keep questioning and keep dig. Kind of keep questioning and keep challenging the status quo, right? Because quite often you do become complacent, right? And the fact is, when you're doing something day in, day out, it's very easy to kind of get into that routine. of not thinking more broadly or really kind of questioning why you do the things that you do, right? And typically that's why it's quite good to get new people coming into the organization, right? Because as a new person, you're hoping that you're going to get somebody who keeps asking the questions why, right? Like, as much as you don't like your children asking why all the time, right? Ideally, in the workplace, I love it when I've got a new person that comes in and really questions the person who's teaching them, well, why do you do it that way, right? Like, and it just gets people thinking a little bit differently in their day-to-day jobs, right? Because that's probably the hardest thing, is getting people to think differently in something they do every single day. And also there's been a mentality of, well, if it's not broken, why fix it, right? But just because it's not broken doesn't mean that you shouldn't be doing some repairs along the way, right? So like it's like servicing a car, right? So yeah, still drives, just might not be optimal.
And if you're not reviewing it, how do you know if a bit of it's broken or not? That's the
Exactly,
point, yeah.
exactly. We had a student last year that we were putting through the apprenticeship scheme in the UK, and she kept on doing the why thing to her boss on maternity pay, and she kept going, why? You know, like, why? And they realized that actually what was happening, that there was they were doing maternity pay wrong for one client. And it was picked up because she was like, but what, you know, why? And it's brilliant, isn't it? I love it when people challenge you. Sometimes you don't like being challenged or what they're challenging you about, but actually it can make you stop, can't it, and think, oh, actually, yeah, let's look into that. And I don't think it's complacency, is it? It's more about that you're busy. You've just got so much going on. Exactly. And I think that is a big piece for a lot of payroll managers and even for myself, right? Like, I do a lot of reading on the weekends because I just don't have time during the week, right? When you're in back-to-back meetings and you're dealing with whatever you're dealing with on a day-to-day basis. And I think that's probably the hardest thing, is giving people space to actually be able to do that. And it's really hard when you're running, you know, a BAU function. I'm quite lucky, we run a fortnightly payroll, but you know, there's a lot of organizations that run weekly, fortnightly, and monthly pay runs, right? Like even my last organization, that's what we were doing. We were running multiple weekly pay runs, fortnightly pay runs, and monthly pay runs. And so you then get into that kind of churn, and you don't get time to step out of that, I guess, that process to really kind of go, hang on a second, is there a better way to do it? Or you might know there's a better way to do it, but you don't have time to test it and really give it a lot of thought. And you always go, oh yeah, we'll do it next month, we'll do it next month. And then you find that, you know, you're 3 years down the track and you still haven't done what was a good idea 3 years ago, right? Like,
That's I think that's life.
yeah.
It
And so, speaking of
is.
time has caught us up, but it would be very remiss of me not to mention that we've been recording this podcast, and obviously you're based in Australia, Mel and I are based in the UK, so we really appreciate you staying up late in your night and
It's
continuing
not
to
that
discuss
late,
payroll.
29 o'clock.
Oh, well, there you go. It's not too bad, but it's still outside office hours. So thank you so much for doing that. It's been an enlightening conversation, and we really appreciate your
No,
participation
thank
and the
you.
thoughts.
Thanks,
Thank
Val.
you for having me.
This podcast is made possible by ADP Global Payroll, giving you the confidence and transparency to transform global payroll into an engine for growth. Begin your journey at adp.com/worldwide and connect with your local global expert.